everyone, and welcome to episode 36 of season 11 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning HBO miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again on this World War II season is one of my World War II experts, especially dealing with the European theater, especially dealing with the Normandy area, is documentarian extraordinaire, Christian Taylor Johnson. Welcome back to the show, Christian.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. So glad you narrowed down that scope because, I do have very limited expertise.
Well, we all have limited expertise. It's just a question of where, you know, and that's it. And so, but that's fine.
I'm learning all the time. Love to learn new things.
Yeah, that's what we all do. That's the great thing about it. There's always much to learn. You know, I don't know how people even 50 years ago learned as quickly as we're able to learn these days. You know,
so true.
Because now you have a question, you just type the question in and you get the answer. You don't have to find a person who actually knows the answer.
Yep, it's true.
That works. Okay, so why don't you start off by telling everybody what is your background with Band of Brothers?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, my background is that I refused to watch Band of Brothers for many years. It came out in 2000, right?
2001.
I probably did not watch this until 2000. Let's see, when was it? 16? 2016?
Wow. Wow, you held it for 15 years. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I had to go to Normandy first and actually see the things and become, you know, interested in the actual history before I was willing to endure the, you know, the violence and the hard things that happen. I have a really hard time with visual blood and guts. In fact, the very first job I had was at a veterinarian clinic, and they invited me to come help out in the first surgery. And I went in, and when they made the first cut, I passed out right there on the floor. Wow. So I learned early on that veterinarian work and doctor work was not for me. So I had to overcome that kind of difficulty seeing those things in order to watch Band of Brothers. And thankfully,
we picked three great 5 minutes.
I know. When you assigned this one to me, I was like, "Oh man, did you give me the easy part?"
You wanted Carrington, so I didn't think about the bloody aspect of it. So I apologize for that. But again, we want your expertise. So this is your expertise. So you know.
Yeah, I didn't think about that either. When I think of Carrington, for me, I studied it so much, and I love the town. It's one of my favorite towns in Normandy. I love the 101st. You have two sons that have fought with the 101st, so they are near and dear to my heart. And so I forget about a lot of the difficult things. It's like childhood when you have children; you forget the difficulty.
And that's why people have more children afterwards.
Exactly. So it's the great trick of the world. Anyway, so
okay.
I didn't.
We're not going to go into too much detail about the gore here. You know, we'll mention it and work our way through. We will not Perfect. Dissect that.
So Band of Brothers, I didn't watch it until I had actually become a filmmaker and or interested in telling those stories. And I started watching it first and learning more about the characters and even more of the history. And then once I began filming, I began to meet actually the actors as well as some of the veterans themselves. And that has been an incredible honor to say that I, have just been a part of this story. So,
right.
Yeah.
Very true. True. Well, have you met any of the men from Easy Company? Or because by 2016,
well, I met Brad Freeman. Brad Freeman, he was actually one of the Band of Brothers,
right?
Mm-hmm. But he was not in the film,
right?
And I know that because when I interviewed Brad Freeman, he was so proud of this book. He showed me a book that was given to him by Dick Winters. And I think the book was Hang Tough, and it was signed by Dick. And it said, you know, to one of his dearest friends. And I don't remember the exact wording, but he said something to the effect that you may not have been included in the film, but you know you were there, and so do I. And you know more, you know, than anyone else, kind of thing.
Wow.
You know, hang tough, Dick. And they had a very special relationship. He invited Brad to come and stay at his house. Brad was a very simple man. He was very quiet. He was a mortarman. There is still damage in the in Braycor Manor from one of the mortar rounds that he shot. And I met Brad actually for the very first time at Braycor Manor in September of 2017 when I was there with Danny. And it just was a random meeting. You know, I'm using air quotes, random. It was a random meeting. And what was so crazy was that Brad Freeman is from Mississippi. So my home state, not far from where I was born. And we had that in common. And, you know, also the fact that he liberated Danny's town. And the day that Brad was there on D-Day, he liberated Danny's aunt and uncle as well, because they worked at Braycor Manor.
Oh,
and
wow.
They were there that day. Yeah. Anyway, that's more information than you asked for, but
no,
that's
you know,
some of my
Christian, as much information as you give, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. That's some of my context of the Band of Brothers.
Right. Okay. Wow. Well, do you remember when Brad passed away?
Like, it was just last. Ago? Yeah, it was just last year. And it wasn't. It was so sad for me. I just seen him actually recently, and he was in such good spirits. And he, you know, he really wasn't sick at all. I think he just went away slowly. You know, he was. I think he was 99.
No, he was 97. He died in 2022.
Yeah.
At the age of 97, and he was the last of the men of Easy Company to pass away.
He was the last one. Yeah, what an honor to know.
Sorry, he was the last of the original men. There were a few others that
they were replacements?
Yeah, the replacements that died after that.
Yeah. Yep, he was an original guy. He was there at Toccoa. You know, and I knew Al Mampre as well. So Al Mampre was the other one, and both of those guys were in my movie. Al Mampre was a medic, and Al Mampre was depicted in the fourth episode of Band of Brothers. He was wounded in Holland. He ran out to save one of his lieutenants. I forget his name. And in doing so, he was shot as well. But you don't know that it's Al Mampre. It's just that.
Ah, okay. Right. It's where Lieutenant Brewer.
Brewer. Right.
The one who turned around, and that saved his life.
Correct. Yeah. Brewer.
And then the medic ran over to him, and the medic got shot. And
Al Mampre.
And he got shot in the leg, I believe.
Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, a lot of people, I was talking to my counselor about this today. I struggle so much personally dealing with, you know, my own sense of identity in terms of success and failure with our film, just because it's not been financially overwhelmingly successful. It's basically just barely paying for itself. But you know, other people involved in the film talk about how successful it's been in so many other ways. And it has. And one of the ways that I think about that, and or I'm reminded of things, is a typical scenario that happened with Al Mampre. He talked about that exact episode. When he was shot, he was lying there, and he also heard this woman screaming in Dutch. And he remembers these houses in this row. And, you know, when things become so clear in a chaotic moment. Everything slows down. He talked about it slowing down and him just being able to hear things. And this woman just kept crying out, and he remembered what she was saying in Dutch. I don't. And he would say those words over and over again. And he always wanted to know, where those houses were, what this woman was saying. And he never could find that. And right before he died, like the summer before he died, someone had connected with me and asked me if I knew any veterans that wanted to go to Holland that September. And I asked Al, I have someone that wants to give a veteran a free trip to Holland. Do you want to go? And he, of course, said yes. And he and his daughter went. And it was during that trip, they connected with a historian that was able to find that house and tell him the story of what had happened.
Wow.
And in a sense, it had given him such peace and resolution, and he couldn't stop talking about it. And not long after that, that was September, and he passed away in May. Actually, yeah,
he was supposed to be
our guest of honor at the opening, of The Girl Who Wore Freedom in Normandy at the Utah Beach Museum. He was supposed to be our guest of honor, and he passed away the day before he was to get on the plane.
Wow.
It's just a devastating thing. I'll never forget. He was such a close friend. And, he was just such an amazing person, Al was, and just so generous and loving. He was supposed to be a Episcopal priest is what I think he wanted to be. And he lived his life that way. He lived his life really, I think, in that kind of way. And he was so loved by people. But that was, I feel, a way in which our film was successful, in that it gave somebody a measure of a peace that he would not have had otherwise.
Right. That is unbelievable. That's great.
Yeah. So I'm thankful for that opportunity.
Completely understood.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, okay. Just more of my context with those Band of Brothers. I mean, the other thing that I've been able to do is, see where they trained in Toccoa. Have you been there? Have you had the opportunity?
No, not yet.
I have gone up Kurahi. I did not run, I'm sad to say, but I did drive alongside two French people, Thomas and Flavie, who are both in my film. Thomas is the handsome soldier that gives candy to Danny, and Flavie is one of the French townspeople, and they came over from France and wanted to run up Kurahi. And so they did, and I drove along in my car playing the music from Band of Brothers, and saying 1 mile up and 1 mile down, and just yelling
three
at
miles
them.
Three miles up.
Yeah. Did
you scream Hyo Silver?
I did. I screamed it all, and just as they were running all the way up, they made it all the way up, and then we took pictures, and it was just absolutely beautiful. And they've now sent over some of the they were horse stables in England where the boys stayed. And so they've sent them over. They were going to be torn down in England, and they've sent them over, and now they are in a museum in Toccoa, Georgia. So there's a wonderful museum there. So
yeah, one of my previous guests had been there also, and he did the same thing. He started walking, and then he said after like taking a few steps, he decided he was just going to drive up.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't in shape enough at the time to do that, but I'm getting better in shape, and I think my goal is going to be to walk up one day.
Okay, excellent. Walk up or run up?
Walk.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so episode 36 begins with Spears basically walking away from Blythe.
Yeah.
And ends with Welsh taking on the tank. So, in yesterday's episode, we had the nice discussion between Spears and Blythe about the chaos of war, and basically he didn't say it in this way, but shit happens, and everyone's scared. Just a question of how you deal with your fear and stuff like that. And
yeah.
We just get a few seconds of that when Spears is walking away, and then we see on the screen that it says D-Day plus 7. So now we are on June 13th, 1944. We've skipped ahead a little bit, a few days.
Yeah, and I want to give a little context because a lot has happened between, when they get into Carentan and when where we are now on June 13th. And I only learned this by being in Carentan during the Normandy ceremonies, but Carentan is technically liberated on June 12th. And that's when they celebrate their liberation every year. And on that day, they had a Silver Star ceremony in the middle of the Place de la République. And all the town was assembled there, as well as 101st Airborne Division soldiers. And there were children there with flowers, and there were, soldiers there all standing at attention and in their rows. And there were speakers, generals that were speaking. I can't remember which generals were there. Maybe Collins. I would have to look back for sure. There are photographs of this event. And there is a sniper that begins shooting and shoots a young girl named Daniel Linné, as well, and wounds other children, I think, and 101st soldier. I need to be clear on my details. I can't remember it all, except I know that Daniel Linné was killed. And there is a plaque on the Place de la République now that talks about who she is and talks about that day. But it tells you that Carentan was still a very dangerous place. And this 5 minutes begins to show you that all was not truly liberated, because this area where this battle is taking place still technically is Carentan. It's just not right in the city center. It's more outside.
I mean, they that's what they say here in the at the beginning of this segment. It says D-Day plus 7, and then it says that on the outskirts of Carentan. So
yeah,
still, I guess within the town limits, but people are not living, or it's not the hustle and bustle of the town itself.
Yeah, and but it's still the town, and it certainly is still the town today. Right now, where this scene is taking place, there is a grocery store, and this scene, we were talking about this earlier, is known as Bloody Gulch. And it is, you'll see why. I mean, as you watch this 5 minutes, I mean, there's a huge transition between this conversation with Spears and a transition within Blythe, obviously. You see kind of this huge transition that happens with him. I feel like in some senses I am Blythe, like I told you in the beginning. I really relate with how he feels. I certainly don't want to watch or hear any of that horrible stuff, and my stomach turns as his does, and want to close my ears as he wants to. It's just so torturous.
Right. Understandable. And so at this point, we see that the men are within the trees, preparing for something. We're not sure 100% for what, but they are preparing. And at this point, one of the men shows up and he goes, "Got smokes? You want some of that candy?" No. No, he goes, "No, I'm all right." And the third one goes, "The outpost got ammo." And they go, "Hey, boy, here you go." And then we overhear Welsh talking with his sergeants. And he basically goes, "No, we don't know what they've got. We may be attacking a weaker force, possibly more paratroopers." And Hubler says, "And you know how that can be." And he goes, "Fire and maneuver. That's the name of the game. Fire and maneuver." He goes, Dog and Fox companies will be on our left flank, moving with us." He goes, "Any questions?" And they all shake their heads, and basically all clear. He goes, "All right, let's make them holler." Picante basically looks at his watch, and he goes, 9:30 in the evening back home. And he goes, must be. Now, first of all, I believe this is a mistake, because between France and the East Coast, it's a 5-hour difference. So even if we were to say it's 6-hour difference, that means it's 3:30 in the morning here, because, you know, in France, it's ahead by 5 or 6 hours, depending on where you are. So I don't know how this type of mistake got through. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, what did he? What did he say exactly? He said
it's 9:30 in the evening back home.
Right. Yeah. And so, do we have any idea
interpreting that any other way?
Yeah. What time do we have any idea of what time is it there?
What time it's in Carrington?
Yeah.
No. No, but this is not. This can't be 3:30 in the morning.
Right.
There's too much light, happening here. So it's a little strange, that they would have gotten something like that.
Very good point. You were very good at checking the minutia. I don't know how that would have gotten through either.
Exactly. I mean, we know there are mistakes, and people will hear my interview in probably about a month and a half from now with one of the main writers, Bruce McKenna, and he talks about the fact that when you're writing, you do make mistakes, and things don't get caught, and that's it. Things do get through, but there are certain things that shouldn't get through. And you'd think a line like this would be a little strange.
Yeah, so, for sure.
So I don't know.
It's
not really possible to know for sure.
I'm talking with my historian friend right now, who is in France, actually. His name is Denis Vandenbrink, and he is in my film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom. And he says the Battle of Bloody Gulch starts in the evening of the 12th. The evening of the 12th.
Okay.
101st, mostly the 506th and the 501st, are extending the perimeter southwest of Carentan. And the 17th SS are counterattacking. The big battle, the second battle of Carentan, starts at 5 on the 13th, when at the same time, 2nd and 3rd 506 move along the Perrier Road and bumps into the 17th. Then comes the cavalry, the 2nd armored with the tanks, and becomes Roosevelt's butchers as they literally slaughter the SS troops. So if it starts on the evening of the 12th, then it would start at 5 a.m., he's saying. So if it starts the night of the 12th, it would have started at night.
Right.
And then the next battle would start at 5 a.m., right?
Yeah. So, on IMDb, it does mention it in the goofs. And it says, before the battle ensues in the hedgerow, Frank Ricconti says it's 9:30 in the evening back home. The time difference between France and EST is 6 hours, meaning it would make it 3:30 a.m. in the scene, and it's clearly light outside, and the earliest sunrise in France at that time of the year is 5 a.m.
Yeah. Now, the other thing you have to figure, not that it makes any big deal, is that they were on German time at that time.
Right. Okay.
Right? So there was a different time zone thing going on there, whatever that meant. We would need to look that up, but I just remember somebody telling me that.
Okay, well, first of all, Frank Ricconti was from your state. He's from Joliet, Illinois.
He is from Illinois. Yep.
Right. So you got it. So you add another hour into that, which means that if he says it's 9:30, so then it's 4:30. So it's a 7-hour difference. So I guess that gets a little closer.
Yeah. Anyway, interesting.
The question also is what time was sunrise in Normandy?
You know, you can look that up. It could tell you.
Yeah, I know. On July 1st, and on July 1st, 1944.
No, it would be July 13th.
No, this is July 1st.
June 13th.
June 13th. Sorry, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. June 13th. July 1st is later this week. That's right. Yeah, right. June 13th. So sunrise in Normandy on June, was it 5:44 a.m.? Yeah, That doesn't work.
Oh,
I was
well.
trying to make it work. I was trying to make it
Yeah,
work.
you were. We gave it a good
Yeah,
effort.
maybe he was living on mountain time, so.
Or California time. Who knows? Anyway,
Exactly.
interesting. Well, people make mistakes.
Yes, of course, of course. Again, I just like to nitpick. That's all it is. It's not a question of being upset that these things happen, because it also gives us other things to talk about,
That's
and
true.
that's always fun too.
Now,
You know,
one
and
other thing that I wanted to tell you, I had mentioned to you earlier that I knew of something called Bloody Gully. I asked my historian friend, Denny Van den Brink, about this, and he said that Bloody Gully is a small part of the overall battle of Bloody Gulch. And
okay.
it is a sunken lane that he learned about from British historian Ian Gardner. And it's a small battle that is only the 506.
Interesting.
Yeah, so he had shown me that lane and he had shown me, yeah, so I've seen where this battle of Bloody Gulch takes place. And that's why I knew that there were these two different areas and I thought that they were two different battles. I mean, I guess
Right.
they were
Okay.
two different locations, but it's all around the same day and at the same time.
Makes sense. And then an explosion happens, and someone screams, "Mortar! Take cover! Incoming! Take cover! Down, 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 down!" And then Welsh screams, "Get that OP here! Tell him to hold! I'm checking the lines!" And so Winter shows up at that point, and you can see that Winters is on top of things.
He is, and he's just so commanding.
Yes, he
And
really is.
I will tell you that from all the people that I talked to, Al Manpre in particular and Brad Freeman, they had such incredible respect for him. And they just talked about, what an amazing leader he was. And so everything that he is portrayed as in the film, there isn't any question. I mean, there were a lot of other questions about some things in the movie. But
Yes.
I do not think that he was depicted incorrectly from everything that I've heard about him.
Correct. I've heard the same thing,
Yeah.
from anyone who has spoken with him and interviewed him and knew him. But everyone that I know, that they tell me that Garnier was toned down for the show.
Yes. Yes. And he's, there is a special part in our film that we were allowed to tell a special part of the story in our film, and I think you know what I'm talking about. I'm not going to give it away. The owners of Braycourt Manor did not let Tom Hanks tell this story. They did not want Tom Hanks to have access to this story, but they allowed us to tell this story. And it was a very sad part of the story of Braycourt Manor. And my feeling is that it was the responsibility of Garner,
Of Garnier.
Garnier, yeah.
It's very possible, but do you know the reason why they didn't want to let Tom Hanks
Yeah,
tell that story?
they didn't want it Hollywood, painted, they didn't want it painted by Hollywood to be something that it really wasn't. And when I told them that I would let them tell the story, themselves, that I would just let it be what it was, that's why they were okay with me telling this story. I gave them first
Okay.
right of refusal. I was like, if you don't want it in the story, then we won't put it in. But I
Right.
let the owner of the manor look at it and give me his approval before I put it in the film.
Oh wow. I'm pretty sure that's also in Tim's documentary about Dick. I'm pretty sure they tell that story in there also.
Yeah. What year was that?
2012.
Oh yeah. Probably.
I'm almost positive.
That's probably true because,
You're talking about the shooting, right?
yeah, that's probably true because by that time they had become friends with Tim. Tim Gray, who I introduced you to, who
Yes.
has the World War II Foundation, they began raising money for a statue of to Dick Winters and the Men of Easy Company to put on the
Yes.
grounds of Braycourt Manor. And so they became friends at that time and built that same kind of relationship with him that I did.
I mean, Tim's my interview with Tim will come out next week.
Great.
Next Monday, we'll have, as we close off part three. So,
great.
You know, everyone will be able to hear what Tim has to say about these men and stuff like that. Yeah.
I want to go back to explain one thing about Carentan kind of before we go on. Carentan is basically this fortified city. It's you know, sort of a castle on a hill. It sits up, it's much more of a higher altitude. So it's more of a hill-like. And, you know, the Nazis knew that this was their best place to have, you know, their strong defenses. And so it was the most heavily fortified and defended area. And so that is why it was so difficult for us to attack. And it was so important for us to take. If we had not taken Carentan, it would have been impossible for us to join Utah and Omaha Beach, the forces at those two beaches. And so it was critical for us to take Carentan. And, you know, it was thanks to the 101st alone that we were able to do that.
Right.
But we did lose, you know, so many men in order to do it. The price was very high.
Yes. Unfortunately, in any war, but especially during World War II, the price was very high in just about every one of the battles that we're dealing with. But, you know, as they say, it's the price of freedom.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, again, Winters is definitely on top of things. He says, tell him to hold. I'm checking the lines. And he goes, all easy stations, easy six. Hold in position. Over. And then Welsh wants to continue dealing with stuff. And he goes, go, lock and load. And one of the guys starts running, and we see he gets shot. And he just falls right down. And then easy six, easy red six. I've got mortars across my line. No sign of infantry yet. I'm pulling the OP in. Over. And then we see that the mortar men of Easy Company starting to shoot mortars back also, and you know they start dealing with their range. They go right plus 15, charge 3, range 600, top load, fire. And he goes top load, fire. And then there's gunfire, and at this point. And one of the other guys goes, come on, move it, hurry. And then Winters is back, ready to give people, you know, motivation with what he's doing. He goes, watch your silhouettes on the horizon. And, you know, they all start shooting in the direction of where the Germans are coming from. And then he goes, keep low, go, go, go. And he goes, Percanti, get your men in order, stay low. Pour it at him, Percanti. To your left. Keep going. Keep going. Keep it up. I want fire superiority. Garnier, get him pinned down. You know, and I've mentioned this many times, but the thing I love about the way that they portray Dick Winters, and as we mentioned before, I believe it. He is a commander who knows all of his men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in the thick of battle, he's in the middle of this firefight, giving orders, telling people what to do, telling, and, you know, he knows who each of them are. He knows who Percanti is. He knows who Garnier is. You know, unlike, I mean, we saw this towards the beginning of this entire series, that when Sobel was talking to the men, he just like said, you, and you. You know, like you can tell that he never took the time to get to know who the men were. At least that was the way it's portrayed. You know, whether the real Herbert Sobel got to know the men or not is a different story. But the way that it's portrayed here is that these, you know, Winters knew his men.
And I will say in Sobel's behalf, Sobel's family was very angry with how he was portrayed, as so was he, and did not agree with the portrayal of his character.
Correct. Right. It makes sense.
Understand. You know, yeah.
It's completely understandable. They needed to create, I don't know if villain is the right word, but they needed to create a character to help the men bond.
But the fact is, it was true.
I know. That's the thing.
What happened. Now, you know, You can say it was distorted to a degree, but what happened happened.
Correct.
And there's no getting
Whether
around
they
that.
exaggerated. No, I think the point is whether it was exaggerated or not. And that's the things that we don't know, and we'll never know. Only the men of Easi and Sobel himself knew how far he went with everything. But they all the men have agreed, and they talk about it in the book, and through different conversations I've had with people, who are aware of how the men of Easi got to be so close to one another, they all give credit to Sobel. They said if Sobel wouldn't have been such an ass and the way that he treated them, they might not have been so close to one another.
That's true. We all, it's trauma bonding before the trauma began.
That's right. And one of the things that I've said many times is that Sobel was an amazing instructor, but a terrible leader. That's what it comes down to.
And what's interesting in my interaction with the military, it's really no different than any other business or any other family that you've been a part of. There are amazing leaders, and there are leaders that are terrible. And the way that people respond, the way that you have success or failure, or the way that things come out, really are determined by those different kinds of leaders. And you are never, it is the luck of the draw of what you get. My sons have gotten absolutely horrible leaders, and I will be honest with you and say that most of them that they have received in the army have been ones that have not been good. They have been, and there have been some that have been absolutely horrible. And then others that have, they will never forget, that have changed their lives for the better. And both of them have shaped them. Both of those kinds of leaders have shaped them, some with negative memories and negative experiences, and the other ones with positive ones. And the end of the day, it's not those people that are really the important things. It's how you respond to those people.
Right. But I mean, one of the things is as a soldier in training, you don't really have much of a
You
choice of how
don't.
you're going to respond.
But you do have a choice with how you're going to think about it. And
That's right.
that's the difference.
Correct.
And that's, in a sense, what Spears was saying to Blythe. You're
That's
here.
right.
You don't have a choice. And we're all dealing with this. And it happens, and it's not going anywhere. And so you've just got to figure out a way to deal with it.
Correct. Again, I mean, we know that Spears, as a character and as the real person, somewhat of a Jekyll and Hyde character, from that perspective. But he still is able to give this type of wisdom. It doesn't matter what you think about what he did or what he didn't do. The things we'll never know whether he did or didn't do them. But as Don Malarkey said to Eric Flint, I don't know if you know Eric. Eric is one of the tour guides of the Band of Brothers of the Stephen Ambrose Band of Brothers tours. So Eric said that Malarkey said, "I will never judge a man for what he does in combat." When he was asked the question of whether it was true or not about Spears, and that was the answer he gave.
Interesting.
And nobody knows. Nobody knows. And it's actually one of the greatest mysteries of the story of the Band of Brothers, that nobody knows, and that's fine. It's the idea of let everyone believe what they want to believe.
Well, and I think too, you've got to leave things on the battlefield. I mean, it is a horrific situation, and you do not know what will happen when you are in that situation.
That's right. That's the point. I mean, this battle is just shown really, really well, the way that they're doing things, and especially given how Winters is leading the men, and he's not even shooting. He's just giving them instructions on what they should be doing, and making sure that everything is done well and done properly and stuff like that. And I mean, the book even talks about the fact that the men knew that when Winters was yelling at them and yelling out orders, they automatically just went in and followed those orders. Nobody
What's interesting too
worked
is
about it.
he's in a position during this time to see his men being killed. So he's up there walking around giving the orders to stay on the line and to shoot. And at the same time, he's watching them be killed.
That's right.
And he's telling the others to stick and hold, you know. Rough.
That's right. Yeah. And we see Blythe in the middle of this just going nuts. He's in his foxhole, grabbing his head, trying to cover his ears, not to have to hear anything or
And
anything like that,
screaming.
and just screaming. And at this point they just don't know what's going on with this whole thing. And
And do you know what I think is so, you're going to think it's crazy that I use this word, but I think it's so tender how Winters deals with Blythe. He doesn't
yes.
scream at him or grab him and yell in his face. He just is like, come on, Blythe, come on, and encourages him to get up and comes beside him, and he sees where he is, and it's like he steps in his fear with him. He steps there with him. I mean, it's just so strong, and I just think it gives Blythe the strength that he needs to do the job that he needs to do. And you
Exactly.
see Blythe then make the choice that he has to make to do the job that he has to do that he doesn't want to do.
Correct.
But he would only be able to do that with that kind of leadership. And I think it goes to show you, some leaders believe that, you have to do that kind of yelling to get someone to do what they're supposed to do. But in this instance, there would have been no way for Blythe to have done what he did. But Winters innately knew how to help him. And it wasn't
That's right.
coddle him either. That's the other thing. He didn't do the other way. He didn't coddle him or even let him off,
Right. Exactly. And then cover the crest of the hill. And then Welsh sees the tanks start coming through the brush, the German tanks. And he goes, "Where the hell did that come from?" He goes, "Holy shit, there goes our left flank." And he sees that at this point we're on the ridge, and we see that Nixon and Colonel Strayer are watching everything that's going on. And then he goes, "Sir, Dog and Fox are pulling back." He goes, "What? Who gave that order? God damn it!" And they watch as the men start scurrying away, Dog and Fox. And Winters just keeps giving orders, and he goes, "Keep firing, stay low, keep firing, Cavalcante." And that's the point where he notices Blythe. And he goes, "Come on, Blythe, stand up. Get up on your feet, soldier. Get up, Blythe." "That's right, Blythe." And Blythe starts to get out of his stupor or his trance that he's in. He goes, "You can do it." He goes, "Fire a weapon, Blythe. Hit those goddamn Germans, Blythe." And Blythe then, instinctively takes out his rifle and points it and starts shooting. And it's really cool the way that they show the way that Blythe has begins to shoot, because you even see the bullet like fly out. They do a great CGI shot of of when he's shooting, the way that the bullet just comes out of it. He needs to we do hear the click of the empty cartridge at the end, and then he has to switch it, and he just continues. And Winters keeps saying, "Keep firing, let him have it, keep firing, don't slack it off, let him have it, Blythe, pour it on him, Blythe, get some up there, move it." And Blythe just keeps doing it. And then we once again see the mortars trying to deal with things. And I mean, when I was in the military 30 years ago, so I dealt a little bit with mortars, and one of the things with mortars is that you're not near everyone else. You're on like a different ridge. You're on a different hill, looking over in order to be able to to have the right angle to shoot what you need to do. Because that's why, I mean, people who aren't familiar with the military will look at this and wonder where these guys are, that they're so far away, and that there's no battle going on around them.
Right.
Which is great. So we see that they shoot off a few of the mortars in the direction of the tank. They don't really do much damage. And then the tank shoots at where the men are. And at this point, we see that it's very close to a direct hit. It gets very, very close. And we see Bull just screaming and not knowing what's going on about it also. And then we see one of the guys get shot and his fingers get shot off. But you can also see that the man next to him has a bullet hole in his helmet. So, there are casualties here.
Yeah,
these aren't men that we know who the characters are.
You see a lot. I mean, you see more than that, there's a lot happening here. And it makes you feel like all is
you're
lost.
Right there. But it also makes you feel like you're right there with them.
Yeah, it does. This is pretty up close and personal. And it makes you feel very hopeless. Like you see these big tanks and it doesn't matter that you're undercover. You just feel like sitting ducks.
Exactly. And then Welsh goes over to McGrath and goes, "Let's go, McGrath, on me. Shift your fire right. Down, down." And, we see that McGrath has the bazooka.
Yeah, that's just crazy to me. I really do wonder if that really happened. I mean, my guess is it probably did because I'm sure they have the after action reports. But how brave. That's just crazy.
This is on page 76 of the book. A German tank started to break through the hedge grove on Easy's left flank, exactly where F Company should have been. Welsh told Private John McGrath to bring his bazooka and come on. They raced out into the open field, crouched down, armed with the bazooka, and Welsh told McGrath to fire. The shot hit the turret, but bounced off. I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going to happen tomorrow also. The German tank turned its 88mm cannon towards Welsh and McGrath and fired. The shell zoomed over their heads, missing by a few feet. The tank gunner could not depress his cannon sufficiently because the tank driver was climbing the hedgerow in an effort to break through. Welsh started reloading the bazooka. McGrath was saying over and over, "Lieutenant, you're going to get me killed. You're going to get me killed." But he held his place, took careful aim at the tank, which was at the apex of his climb, cannon pointing skyward. The huge vehicle just about to tip forward as it broke through and fired. He hit exactly where he wanted, the unarmored belly of the tank, and it exploded in a great burst of flame and fire. You see, it really happened.
Amazing.
There you go. According to Stephen Ambrose, it really happened. and the men. And that's how we will close out today's 5-minute segment. Is there anything you wanted to add about the stuff we were talking about today?
No, I think that we covered a lot of stuff today. I don't know what we're going to talk about tomorrow.
Well, don't worry. We're going to have stuff to talk about.
All right.
Have a little faith in me, Christian.
I do.
All right. So today's segment is a band brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you spent hours trying to get this this done, and I apologize for taking up so much of your precious time thinking of fictional bands, but.
But once I understood the assignment, it was a little bit easier, but that wasn't your fault.
Okay. That's okay. That's why you can always ask me questions.
All right.
All right. Start with your number five and work your way up.
All right. Number five, the Blues Brothers. Number four, Jesse and the Pussycats. I am a 70s girl. As you will see by my next favorite, which is the Partridge.
Wait, one second. Do you like the... are you referring to Josie and the Pussycats of the cartoon or the live action?
The cartoons.
Okay, I'm not a fan of the live action one.
No.
I did like the cartoons.
Yes.
I am also a child of the 70s and 80s, so there you go.
All right, the Partridge Family's next. How can you not like David Cassidy? And then Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which I don't know if you can really count that as a fake band, but you know.
It's fine.
And then my number one band of all time, which funny enough, I really thought was a real band, is The Wonders.
Oh, of course. You thought The Wonders was a real band?
I did. When I didn't know, when I saw the film, I had no idea anything about it. Like, I didn't know who made it. I didn't know anything about it. And I watched the whole thing. And then at the end, I watched all of the, you know, credits at the end. I was so engrossed in the movie. I thought it was all real. I thought all the things at the end were the real people. I went and I Googled everybody, you know, and I just loved it. And I wanted the band so much to be real. And, you know, then of course I found out that all was made up by Tom Hanks and whatever, but it is a favorite family film. We watch it all the time, and just great music, great music, great story. The Wonders is my number one by far favorite band. Favorite fake band.
The
Oneaters. The Oneaters.
Exactly. All right, excellent. And now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, where I will randomly give you a hints about a World War II movie, and you have to try and guess what movie it is that we will that we're talking about.
Okay, well, I'm not very good at this, so I know that, again, like I said, I have a very narrow focus, so.
Okay, so hopefully you'll get stuff. I mean, stranger things have happened. People have gotten, you know, they've gotten things that we talked, that we discussed, you know, that we discussed a particular movie, and that day it showed up. So it's possible, and hopefully you will get things today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. There'll be something for you. Exactly. Okay, so let's spin the wheel and see what we get. Round and around the wheel goes, and we're going to randomly get something for Christian to have to try and guess what World War II movie she is going to get. Ooh, okay. This is definitely something that that you should know.
Okay.
I will be amiss if for some reason you don't know about this one. So this is a movie that came out in 1977, directed by Richard Attenborough, and it's all about the Market Garden. You have any idea what movie that might be?
Mm-hmm. Market Garden. All about Market Garden. A Bridge Too Far.
Very good. Excellent.
See, I love that movie.
You did so much better than you thought you would.
So I love that movie because it has so many amazing actors. And yeah, it's in the 70s.
Okay. Very That's sad. Fair. And it takes place, you know, in Holland.
Yes. There you go. It does. One of my favorite places.
Yeah. All right, so Christian, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yes, they can find me at documentaryfirst.com. That is my website and my email address, and all my other pertinent information is on there. You can find me on all the socials at Documentary First. You can message me or DM me, whatever. And you can find me on my podcast at Documentary First as well.
Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook. Find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So, until tomorrow, hurry!